I think there is a fear too when the father kind of knows what's going to happen, and he doesn't want to face it. I mean, he doesn't want to face it. And I think in there, why doesn't the father say that it would kill him? And then she answers that question very truthfully, because he thinks that it wouldn't make any difference to you, and it wouldn't hold you. And to keep having to face that point blank would scare the father. Because he can think it in his head, but it isn't quite as bad. Because in the father's head, when the son does this, if nothing new comes into their relationship before Gene goes, it's going to mean that to him. See? That is the way the son, that he's going to have to see it. Now, if something new doesn't come into the relationship, the son's going will mean that to him. Doesn't make any difference to him, and he's only stuck around for his mother. And if nothing new came in the relationship, and as the relationship was in the movie, nothing would come in. Because the realization, the guy doesn't write the title, "I never sang for my father," until after the father's dead.
As far as like quality and content of conversation, there wasn't much quality and content of conversation, but apparently there had been a potential for that for the father in the past. But why wasn't it going on now? And I think it's something that Carol said about Mary's dad when he was in her breast cancer. Just so happy finally.
One reason for that is that what the father thought was interesting was not what the son thought was interesting, and in a sense the son looked down on what the father thought was interesting. As the song that he wouldn't sing to the father was an old-time favorite that he wouldn't sing.
It seemed like he was so close. It seemed like that's where one of the real anguishes of that movie was, is that in that bedroom scene, they're so close to having some conversation, and it doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's an omission. It doesn't happen, and the son, falls back into his. The opportunity is there, and he just doesn't take that. I don't think it's a step purely of doing just what the father wants, or just doing something only for the sake of the father. But it's a step in conversation between the two. Some sort of new contact they could have. Perhaps it would open up, between them. Maybe that would be a sacrifice on some part, in part, but it would also be a new role. And that's where I see, that's where the movie really hit me. It was just, when it didn't happen, the anguish of the son, you could feel an anguish of the father, too.
You could, and the son says, I never felt, closer. At that time, he really, really felt close, and it was the first time in years. And one thing to remember, that the son is over 40 years old. The son is over 40 years, and I guess that's a little bit where I get, upset with the son is that after, you know, after 21, you don't have any excuse. Come on now. I mean, you know, like Mark Twain said, my dad was a turkey, you know, really a turkey. When I was 20, my dad was really a dummy. But then when I was 21, I was surprised how smart he got in just 1 year. I mean, you know, who got smart in 1 year? And after 21, no excuse. Get it over with. Do not continue the adolescence. I think in some ways the two scenes of the child, the sister and the brother in their rooms that were kept, granted they were kept just the way they were when they left them, but they were sitting there wide awake in those rooms, and in many ways were still struggling through the adolescent difficulties that they had. Remember the tremendous criticism that they were making of the father for not really being, you know, they said, I wanted to talk about my mother, you know, and he's just the same as he always was. And what are they doing at the same time? Doing exact, being just the same as they always were, and while the mother has died, they're talking about the father. They're doing this. They're sitting there, and you know, cutting down the old man for not caring about the mother, and they're sitting there, what are they doing? You know, just ripping them to shreds in the diner. They're saying that old guy, you know, yeah, that guy, remember when he just slammed us? And well, are they doing anything? You know, again, the ambiguity of those scenes, you know, hoofed, or the old man, the first response to the old man kneeling, he says, ah, that old pious guy, you know, he's got a screwed up conception of God, and he says, God, thank you for making me such a nice guy and jumping in bed. I don't think we can say it that quickly, you know. Well, the scene while he is down praying and then he goes to bed, and they're sitting there wide awake, you know, thinking. That isn't necessarily a slam on the old man's religious practice. We cannot say that he was not we can't judge his prayers. We can be convinced that they weren't thinking about prayers in their rooms.
One thing that Father talked about is mother's funeral a lot, and how like he did want his father to come also. How his father sort of left him when he was young, so I think that he sort of really wanted to be opposite of that to his kids and try to build himself up a lot and be good to them. But then when like he was in the hospital when his wife was sick, he's talking about Helen Moffat, that girl, and it got really cut up in the movie I read in the book. Like he was sort of in love with her. He never seemed like he wanted to show any emotion from his son, wanted to be really sort of solid, but a couple of times like that, I think he was really in love with her and he wanted to marry her, but Helen's mom told her not to marry him because she didn't think that he was his father, Tom's father himself, was good enough for her, so he had to leave her, but I think he really felt guilty for that. And I think that sort of maybe trying to tell his son something about himself. Also about telling his son that he was so really sorry for his father, sort of, I think, what his father was like. How he did that a lot of times. I think his father sort of tried to talk to him sometimes about myself.
Yeah. And in a sense, even though his timing was odd, the father was one up on being vulnerable to the son.
It was like, talks about you were off on your burden. I'm not exactly sure what that means, but he says, when I kept my burden or something like that. And I think he sort of didn't want his son to have to have him and stuff, so he tried to always just be really strong for him. Break up. He'd break up like that one time. He just tried to stop. But
yeah, and that. and the business was when his father then says, you know, take, he says, don't, let me put these away from you, for you. Oh, don't, no. I can do it. And then he says, no, you do it. You know. And then just a minute later, he turns around, though, and he says, I'm going to get him. I want to keep him here, you know, and gets possessive, you know, of this, of the son. Yet, if you count in that movie that the times when face to face there was a, you know, part of the soul was shared, the father is up on the son.
And also, like, one thing with Esther Anhoy says, never spend a day where he could look anybody in the face and tell him to go to hell.
Mm-hmm.
He lived like that. And even his own children, like how he managed his daughter. And she sort of, I think that's sort of the same attitude where she wouldn't expect anything, she would expect to look
mm-hmm.
around.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder how you can really have too much happiness if your father, or even your father, is, thinks everything's bad. Right?
Yeah.
Not be surprised if anything goes bad because it's the wrong path.
You mean like his just his crankiness and stuff?
No.
Or
his, well, you know, then when he was going out and he said before I slammed the door, he said,
I've lived my whole life.
I lived each day of my life so that I could look any man in the face and tell him to go to hell. And I sort of think Alice really thought that too in her thinking. She
And she's perfected it far better than than he has. See, that's something. Did he? It was that true from what we know of the father in the movie. Was that a true statement? I think we jumped to the conclusion that it was. But is it true from what we've seen of the father in the movie and what we've heard said about him from people outside the family, and the mother too, and the son saying, "I can't touch what you've done." And he admits, see, the son says, I can't touch it. You know, he raised his first family between the ages of 8 and, you know, 8 and 16. That was when he raised his first family. Then you get this, him saying at the end, I lived every day of my life so I could look any man in the eye and tell him to go to hell. Now that definitely is a horrible thing if that's true.
Well, maybe that's just the point. I mean, maybe the point there is that he's been able to be honest with, you know, or see what's on his mind, be it hell or heaven,
mm-hmm.
you know, outside of the family, and even the family. I mean, you know, no matter what the games are, he's playing, I think he's been a point of honesty as far as he was concerned. He had the courage to go ahead and move into play the games the way he wanted to play. So, you know, he just can't freeze on the word hell. I think he spoke out for he felt he should in all instances. And that carried through right to his kid. I mean,
mm-hmm.
he played the games with them. He manipulated and met his, had it, you know, his needs were being met, his wife, and he moved her. I shared your anger, but I had some anger with her. Well, with the wife, too, because she finally accepted what he wants at TV, but I think she should have stopped it years ago.
Mm-hmm. Huh?
Well, I guess she didn't have to stop because she did accept it. And, I guess maybe the son, if he didn't like it, he should have done something earlier. Like maybe when he was 20, you know. But to go on for 20 more years with that kind of relationship is sick.
Yeah. I think that's a real point. When the kids leave home, you got to make, I would imagine you have to make a, I have a whole new courting, you know, I would imagine, to get to know each other in a way that you never haven't for the last, you know, the last 20 to 30 years. I think the whole emphasis is, you know, that, you know, the wife is, you know, very busy in the home with the kids, and the husband is out there trying to, you know, get
get things so that the kids can make it through school and so forth, and to whatever he wants for them. And is it at the very time when they're just, you know, working, you know, kind of parallel things, but they're really busy, and then all of a sudden the kids are done, and they say, yes, and who are you? You know, and I think there needs to be, hopefully there'd be an awareness that that's a very crucial time, you know, to meet each other again. You know, I figure that that getting angry at the father is the easiest, so that's why we're not spending much time on that, because I think that's pretty easy. But we talked about getting angry a little bit with his son. What Tim brought up about the daughter taking one phrase of the father and then running it. Now the daughter was really tortured. And what did she say? Like hell I'm grateful, you know? But she took one phrase of the father and ran with it and cut her own, you know, the father didn't cut her whole soul out. Now the any father cuts some of the soul out of a son or a daughter. Any mother does. Just by being human. But also puts you know, helps some other grow. And there were things to learn from him besides look everybody in the eye so that you can tell them to go to hell and don't expect anything out of anybody. Now, that wasn't all that was taught in that family, but that's what she took. And she just oofed to that scene when she's, you know, she's more a man in all the worst meanings of man, too, than Tom was. Yeah. Okay, why?
Because she allowed herself to assume the passive role of non-involvement in the good person in the family where everybody took their troubles to. But she never got involved in the conflict.
She never got involved in what?
The conflict.
Never got involved in the conflicts. Okay, what is that in a sense? What does that make of her in relation to the son and daughter in relation to the father?
Well, what I really picked up on that in the bedroom scene where the son was telling his mama his troubles like a little boy, and she was comforting him instead of encouraging him to be a man. Mm-hmm. You know, he was 40 years old, and instead of saying you're a man, you can handle it, you talk to your father. He said, oh, I'll talk to him,
and
I'll take care of it.
It's okay, darling. Okay. All right. And in relationship, then, you've got allies. The mother is an ally. The mother and the son and the daughter are the allied powers. Well, what's the name for the other powers? Germany. The Axis powers. But there wasn't this allying business. It's a completely natural world thing. It's in a family. I think it must be just from the devil. I mentioned this in talking to some guys the other night at that party. If Elise gave a knowing look to somebody else, anybody else, if I say something, meaning it well, and she looks to somebody beside and goes, you know, and I saw that, what would it do to my gut? Okay, since I'm telling the story, it would really hurt. And we just saw some parts, but Ma and son were exchanging knowing looks, knowing glances, and you know, you're making a fool out of yourself. You know, well, if you want to go make a fool out of yourself, like that. There's a kind of very natural, but in the perspective, right side up and an upside down world perspective, perverse quality to that kind of thing. It's natural, but there's a perversity about it. Now, from the father's point of view, who was courting the mother? Who was courting his wife while he was upstairs listening to the singing downstairs? You know, there's courting going on. Yeah.
Also in the book it mentioned, there was one part that left out of the movie that was in the screenplay about how he says how he used to dance with mother and stuff and the father was...
Yeah, I couldn't remember that either.
It wasn't in the movie, it was left out.
He was singing to his mother, see.
Yeah. But yeah, something he mentioned that he used to dance with his mother.
Yeah,
and
listen,
father was
I'll read that. Yeah, I'll read that.
Right in the bedroom before, I think.
I remembered part of that phrase, but I didn't remember the dance phrase, but you do remember it, Eileen. You know, he won't listen to things I want to hear down here in Florida. There's only one TV in the lounge, and he wrote her on it. And then he'd go to sleep in 2 minutes. Still, he's a remarkable man. Good old mom. Well, he is. Not many boys have fathers they can be as proud of. I know that. I'm very proud of him, and he said it as if it were a chore. She catches his tone. Everything he's done for his family. So he didn't dance with me at parties. You took care of that. You were just a great dancer, Mother. What a shame that children can't see their parents when they're young and courting and in love.
I remember that movie.
You do remember? Okay, so he didn't dance with me at parties, but you took care of that. You know, there is, you know, a difficulty there, a seeking of an ally, there she is, and then working it. And for that to happen and for the father to be upstairs, and he can talk, the son can talk to the mother, but can't talk to the father has a heck of a time talking to the son. It's not as if he looked every man in the eye and told, you know, so they could tell him to go to hell. He looked at, he couldn't live that way with his son. He blew up with his daughter. No justification we can give him there. I don't think we can give him justification. I don't think we can justify or condemn anybody. We can describe and define and then pray. But this, in many ways, there are things that a son has to deal with his father, but it's so much easier to deal with a mother, and the son will choose that. Mom's easy. And I can get around mom. And for one, she can see in me those things she saw in him when they were young and courting. And I can somehow be safe with mom. Where dad will say, "What do you mean by that?" And that business, I don't know, and not in a perverse, in a sense like, oh boy, ring up Freud and let's get him in here on this, Oedipus complex. You know, no, not like that. Not like, you know, doesn't have to look like that Oedipus complex is an extreme, you know, is a natural thing to the extreme. You know, to the extreme. Just as all in real crazy things are natural things, just, you know, really, schizophrenia is falling for a metaphor. My love is like a rose, and then you marry, you know, you marry a rose and put a ring on it, and then you're nuts, you know. But anyway, that was going on in here. That was really going on in this movie too. And the father was in a very you know, difficult position. While he was out there working like that, there were new alliances being formed behind the lines. And that was a very difficult thing. A really difficult thing. And part of the sense, one of the things that I had difficulty with the mother, not so much as a solid thing that was in there, as one that wasn't there. What wasn't there was a recognition that she was as vulnerable to criticism as Tom Garrison was. No one can bear scrutiny. You know, no one can bear scrutiny. And ironically enough, maybe Tom Garrison was the one that knew that better than all, and that's why he hit so much. But the other characters thought they could bear scrutiny. And ironically enough, the girl breaks down crying when she realizes she can't. The sister. But there were two people in the movie that thought that they were righteous. And the sister thought she was righteous until she broke down crying. And in the movie, the two people who thought that they were more righteous than the others were the mother and the son. And that was scary because they looked so nice. And that mama, boy, what, didn't she look like mama? You know?
She just,
No, I mean.
You couldn't criticize her because there was, I couldn't really grasp onto anything that really marked character in her to criticize.
Mm-hmm.
But this jelly-like ally molded to the father, the son, the father.
She sure had a good line though on that. Well, we've had you all these years, and we should be, you know, we should really be. We're glad that we had you this close, this many, you know, this many years. And I really said, "Yay, Ma!" You know, at that point, you know. But all those years of the, and the thing is that, that the sons, the mother knew, or the father knew, that, in the garage, when the father says that. You know, you're all, you know, your whole life, her whole life is you. You know, it always has been. I've known that all these years. You know, that's hard. To have been a situation that she allowed to take place. To be devoted to the son.
But
like that.
It seems like she really loved her husband a lot, too. Because she made a lot of things like a wonderful husband. Even so, he had his craziness is really still like them, but never really saw any place where he acknowledged her.
Well, okay, staying away from the father for a minute, damn it, that's treating him like a boy. I'm proud of you. You're a remarkable man. And it wasn't like, you know, it was like she was proud of, you know. You know, didn't that seem that way to you? I mean, it was a little bit like being proud of him like a boy. I mean, there's a emasculating quality when you say, look at that, you know, he never doesn't know where he's going all the time, but he gets there, you know, and isn't he this and that and the other thing, but it isn't, you know, it just isn't a real,
At the dinner table, she said, well, go ahead and make a fool out of yourself.
Yeah, we got to realize that their old age. Or what? What did you say?
I was just mentioning something. It was irrelevant to the point.
Oh. But the age does make a difference there, too. She's not as old as he is. But still, there's this, in a sense, the kinds of comments, the parliamentary comments of the son, in a sense, is just as much trying to raise the father, if not more trying to raise the father, than the father is trying to raise the son still. Trying to teach his dad. Teach his dad. And there is a schoolmarmish quality to what as if she's talking about a pupil that I did have difficulty with. That I had difficulty with. If Elise or I was talking about Elise or she was talking about me, that way I would just, you know, I'd cringe. If I was talking about Elise, as if she was a, you know, in a school, you know, a pupil of mine.
I think near the end, the son sees that in the bedroom scene, he sees that maybe he should have had some sort of ally with his father as well. When he tells the father that how much the father liked this one little song, and the father said, "Did you used to sing that for me?" And James said, "You asked him to, but I never did."
Yeah.
And it was kind of like how many things that the father asked him to do that he never did. It kind of probably was a little foreshadowing to the final thing where the father wants him to stay, but he doesn't.
Of his not singing the song, and the father's forgotten that, right? About the song, father has forgotten that, isn't holding that against him, but the son remembers all of a sudden. That I already, you know, that I didn't ever sing that. Yeah, and that in a sense has built, you know, built that thing. And the classic exchange of that whole thing, and where you, if you look at that situation in terms of justice, was it just for the father to do what he did, or just for the son to do what he did? You just can't look at that in terms of justice. We don't need justice. We don't need justice. Jesus didn't come for justice. He came to give grace. But that business of it, where finally the son, after 40 some years, and you could figure it out, he was, you know, 20, he's about 42 years old, son's 42 years old, and finally comes out with it. You can't tell me that your door is always open to me. And, you know, what does the father say? Yeah, it's not my fault that you never came through.
Yeah.
And in a sense, that the son was the mama's boy, probably pretty quick, you know, in the game, and he was upstairs listening to him sing, pretty quick in the game, and scared. And then at the end, you know, his not doing that. There's the crazy thing. I don't think he should have stayed there. You know, I don't think he should have stayed there. That isn't what I'm. You know, I think what he said in terms of the offer. You know, come and we'll get an apartment. Come and live with us. There's nobody here that knows you anyway. You know. That's about the best he could do in that situation, in responding to that his wife is out, you know, his future wife is out there, her kids are out there, she's got her practice out there. That's kind of what he has to do. He doesn't have to leave that night and never come back, you know, but that's almost what he had to do.
Also, I think about that song, like, I got kind of moved that. When his dad was really old and the kid was born and stuff. And I had that song was When I Grow Too Old to Dream. I wanted to sort of the father could sort of think, you know, I'm a lot older than he is. I mean, you know, really old. And I'll be really even older pretty soon. How, you know, not I'll be retiring and you know, he sort of wanted to try to tell his son that something.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't seen that song.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I don't think that they're old and getting older, but really like them.
Yeah. If he had sung that song to him, he'd be sure he'd to have remembered it. In the place in the play, he didn't remember it. Remember? Oh, did I ask you to sing that for me?
Yeah.
You know, that thing. But he forgot it. He, in the sense that he wasn't holding that against the kid as a specific thing. But I think that's part of maybe why the author chose that title. You know, because hopefully he would have some good memories besides, you know, of the love of the son and the relationship between the son and so forth. And he's created some things that he's really regrets, I'm sure. And then he doesn't have much coming up in the future for him. But also that's for the son, who's this writer, you know, probably very aesthetic, intelligent, gotten a good education and so forth. That's a schmaltzy old song. When I grow too old to dream. And he's not going to sing that, you know, too. And this aesthetic, this aesthetic distance, you know. And it's funny, that comment about the picture, you know. Father says, I like to look man to look me straight in the eye.
On the book.
Yeah, on the book. It's not so much, when you look at the whole dialogue there, it's not so much a criticism of the son as not being a man, but the son is a man, and he thinks the son is more of a man than somebody who will sit there like this, you know, in a turtleneck sweater and go like this on the cover of a book. He says, that doesn't look like, you know, you're more of a man than that. And then, of course, it's his value system, too. But still, behind that is, this is my son, you know? And that one of the frightening things in that movie is that on a quick look, you get one pretty straight picture, you know. And then you can start looking at some of the other things and you find out that it's a lot more ambivalent. Now we could have, there would be no problem coming down on Tom Garrison. You know, because he's blatant. He's blatant. His sins are blatant. Everybody else's are subtle. And there's a kind of something about the hollering in this one family. You know, there's something that I didn't know that Jewish families are that much that way, but there's something oddly healthy about the Italian families that I that I knew. That had there been more, I think our society it messes some things up pretty much, you know, in terms of this with holding everything in, and I made it all the way through high school without ever raising my voice to my father and telling my mother to shut up once and getting zapped in the mouth for it. You know, a bottled up kind of thing. But that doesn't keep it, you know, I was the nicest boy in town. But the wheels were, you know. And I wasn't only just a bastard, but that was one of the things. You know, but the wheels were turning. And the looking and the watching and the object, you know, this sort of thinking I had on things understood. Yeah, Tom's were blatant. And we live in a very subtle age. And as Christians, I think we can almost count on our sins being subtle instead of blatant. You know, we can almost count. We aren't out there raping people. You know, we aren't out there getting, you know, saying, damn those mechanics, can't ever do that and everything. You know, we aren't out there, you know, just run down the list. We aren't doing those things. But to say that we aren't doing, we're doing subtle things. Little things in the head. You know, little things in the head every day. And sometimes you say, we don't think we do, but just in our definitions of people, you know. Murdering people with your definitions, you know. So-and-so is like that. Okay, you just killed him. You know. So it's strange.
One thing I was thinking about was, like Tom's father sort of completely ignored him and left.
Yeah.
Him. And Tom talks about how he says, and I shoved him off, like at the funeral stuff. So I think that also means like he sort of shoved him out of his life because he hated him.
Mm-hmm.
And then he sort of, I think, almost maybe went opposite to his son. And he tried to be too much there all the time. He tried to keep his son there so he would always be by his son still living, and he wanted to sort of
stay with him.
I think maybe he went a bit in the opposite way. And so then his son, Gene, shoved him off too as
yeah.
a father.
Yeah.
And sort of hated him.
That's a really good connection.
Wasn't there a time talking about it, and I shoved him off? I think.
Uh-huh.
I think he also shoved him off his wife. He talked about it.
But he gave him an ornery glove, and he didn't do that.
Yeah. Then the contrast. He died without even an orange in his hand. That picture of which is another thing we're left with besides the title. You know, we're left with that thing. The image that and my father died without even an orange in his hand. That thing. But one thing that he was without a father. He was not going to have the son be without a father. And this exercise in the morning and the business like that was all his. What all he could think of to do. It's what he missed. He grew up without a father, all the time thinking what he wanted of a father. You know. And then to try to be that, you know, for his boy, and loving, this is another big thing, I think, and loving his son in a way that the son didn't want. But had he loved the son in another way, the son would have wanted to be loved in yet another way. I think, does that make any sense to talk about that at all? No? Follow that one again? Well,
can't you be satisfied with the love that you're given?
I would say, okay, I look back on my past. I wish I was loved, you know. I wish more physical affection was shown me, say. And I keep, you know, for a while I thought that was the kind of, that was it. Love is what I didn't get, you know. But I was getting all sorts of other love that it took me a few more years to figure out I was getting all the time. I was getting the love my parents could express to me. And they always couldn't express it in the way I wanted it. And I didn't have a hunger for what I was being, you know, fed all the time. I was hungry for those kinds of love that I wasn't getting. It was wrong of me to think that I wasn't being loved. Tremendously. I just wasn't hungry for the ways because my needs were being met so much that I wasn't getting hungry for them. But I was hungry for some other ways. Had I been loved sort of like bears, affectionately, physically, and so forth, I would have said, yeah, but you don't, you know, love me some other way. You don't love me really. You're just showing, you know, this kind of thing, but it really doesn't have meaning, you know. And I think we are so hungry for love, especially through that period, but always, that we start to say what kinds of love we're missing. And this is in Tournier too, but what we pay attention to what we're missing, the kind of love that we're missing. And we think that if we're missing a certain kind of love, we're not getting another kind of love. And we think that our parents could give us this other kind of love, but choose not to, because they don't. And this is not conscious kind of manipulation that you do in your head, but in terms of feeling, I think it works that way. That they could, but they're not. But many times our parents can't. How could, in terms of this guy, Garrison, how could he come up with anything but a stereotypical way of, you know, stereotypical early 19th century way of what a father should be, exercise in the morning and so forth? He didn't have a father. He didn't have any model. He had to come up with something out of the books, exercising in the morning with the sun, you know, and getting out there and getting the living and being sure that the kid goes to college and then gets his confidence. This is a crazy thing too. I mean, the son is raised in such a way that he's confident enough, not in his manhood business, that has other problems, but confident enough as a brain and so forth to do certain things, to go on and teach, and never think that the father might feel very insecure in his own mind about himself. You know, this is really important as far as I'm concerned. That my father's a doctor, a PhD, who's insecure because of where he came from. You couldn't believe it, but he isn't that confident. And if that can happen that way, well, how much more can it affect somebody who hasn't gone on the kind of work that, say, my dad has done? But to be really this, and also the scrutiny, and then if your kid is getting a better education than you got, and plus you've got this, you know, 14 to 21, hopefully, but in this case 14 to 41, kind of scrutiny, how much more intimidating is that in terms of just scaring the, you know. I think sons expect their fathers to be scrutinizable and stand up. No one can be scrutinized and stand up. No one but Christ. Yeah.
But maybe the father is putting values on him that just are not there, in the sense of, what did you say? You chose to be a teacher. In the kind of condemning kind of way, mm-hmm. of, these are my values.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like the father couldn't love him enough to let him put his own values and live his own life,
mm-hmm.
be it what it is.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what's the alternative to teaching your child the values that you have?
No values.
Is that better?
But there's got to be a point where the father can say, these are my values. I've raised you to have to build your own values. Hopefully they'll come together. Ours are, you know, mine are strong enough to bend and flex and be able to see your values also.
Mm-hmm.
Generations are going to
do that. Hopefully they'll be the same. You know, hopefully they can come together and appreciate each other's. You know, hopefully that'll work. But there really isn't an alternative to teaching your son your values, I don't think. I think
no.
to try not to is a mess. I don't see that it's justifiable. I see it's understandable that the father acts like that. I don't say it's justifiable, that that's the way a father should feel about their children. Not at all. But the father did give values that he were the best he knew. And that gives a child something solid that they can accept or reject. But it gives him something to jump from, either stand on or jump from. He's got to have something. Then hopefully he not to... beat the child with it and so forth. But I think too, in some ways, I changes as one has to think of changing. The youngest generation being considered should be the one that's thinking of changing. Now that there's a point where, you know, in terms of youth, you just can't. I mean, because at certain ages are just too young to really be able to handle ambivalence and to really do some accepting that they just haven't rejected long enough to accept yet, you know. But I think it's the younger generation that could. It is not my job to go to my 91-year-old grandmother and change her theology. You know?
But also, it's not her place to keep you stuck in her values, to demand of you to stay.
I would hope that she doesn't demand, but I hope she tries to teach me everything she knows. I hope she tries to tell me everything.
But you learn different things.
Then maybe what she's telling, yeah. But hopefully I can be taught as much as I can from all the generations of my, you know. Hopefully everybody, you know. And really, after you develop some, you know, I think in getting in Christ, after you get some manhood or womanhood in Christ, you can listen to people telling you that you ought to do this and that and the other thing, and you don't have to sit there and react as if, you know, as if they're trying to push you around, which may be what they're trying to do, but you don't have to react that way. You can talk to them, you can keep talking to them while they, you know. It's a lot harder. I mean, we say it's easy to talk about, a lot harder to do. You know, how easy is it for me to talk, say, with my father? Not very easy. Not very easy at all. My mother? Not very easy at all. This is not something, I'm not speaking out of a position of strength. You know, I wouldn't know anything to say if I wasn't speaking out of a position of weakness. You know, no, you know, none of this stuff is easy. Because you can, you know, you could be Superman, but your mother or father isn't. And if they were, you wouldn't be. So, you know, it just isn't going to work that way. I think a problem is something on the resolution business. Resolution, to insist on a resolution, you know, is not going to work. To insist on a resolution isn't going to work. That life isn't like that. You can't wait for the resolution and then you come up with, aha, this is it. Life is ambiguous. You know, it's sort of like we celebrate within ambiguity under the cross. I mean, it isn't going to be clear cut. They aren't going to do that. I mean, I can't wait for resolution to love, because the resolution never comes. I can't wait until the climate is maybe set, because it will never come. I can't try to decide what's just to do for between my father and I, because I'll never know. But I know what's merciful. But I can never find the resolution, because I think he was right at the end. It never comes. The resolution that never comes. But that's not a dead-end street. It needn't be. That can be where we can teach grace in the way we live, and then show that the parent isn't in a parliamentary world, where if they're weak, we're going to shoot that weak limb off in 2 seconds. Because that anybody shooting at your weaknesses just makes you, you know, just clam up in a second. And especially between fathers and sons. But I think daughters and mothers, daughters and fathers, it works all the different ways. But if somebody's shooting at your weaknesses, you just clam up like nothing. And especially if... I think maybe if you're in the older position. Because the son can always say, of course I'm weak, I'm only a kid. and the father is facing this expectation that the son expects that he's going to be able to make it, bear scrutiny. And the father knows he can't. And the father knows what the son is going to do if the son is shooting and finds out that he can't bear scrutiny, so he tries not to be weak and resist this kind of thing. And it just gets to be a vicious circle. And this is really what it's about in the world, I think. You know?
One thing I'm thinking about, there must be, I don't know if there is or not, some point where, like, a parent or somebody has to sort of think that they've done, maybe not all they could, but done, you know, they've done for so long, taught their values and stuff, and they have to, let the person go with those values and sort of trust that they'll give them some values so they're able to make their own choices and keep the same values but not to not let them go with those values and try them out.
There comes a time when the parents have to let go, you mean? I mean, is that what?
Yeah.
Well, they do. One of the things that kids, at least now, do is that like I live a certain number of years, and then supposedly you become aware at, say, around 12 or something like that, and you've got, or 12 or 14, and then you're really watching the folks, you know. They're watching you for 12 years, teaching you values and everything, and then you start paying attention to them, and then you leave home at 18. You know. Well, they know that they've got a few years to give you some value, but that you are off. To them, it doesn't seem like such a big deal. They know that only, you know, a very few years of your life you're going to be around.
But that is a big deal.
Huh?
That is a big deal for a lot of parents. And
which?
My parents.
Yeah.
That was one of the biggest revelations to them. You know, that caused anguish in them when they realized that their values. Their values could no longer be reinforced every day anymore. And I don't think it was a loss of power, really, but in a sense, yes. You know, they no longer had that immediate
control,
right, okay. Over the child. And one very big role of theirs is completely abolished, just no longer exists. It's like stepping out of a play. They no longer have that sort of function. And I think that's a real thing that I'd like to ask other parents, but that's a real thing that parents go through. At some point, when they lose a role,
oh yeah,
a very significant role.
Like Gene's mom was ready to let him go. And like you said, you go to California, but then
what?
Go to California.
Like his dad didn't ever want to let him go. Got to the point where she could.
Yeah.
It took longer.
Yeah.
It seems to me like the father didn't want to let his son go.
No. I think there's an awful lot of. He didn't, I don't think. The father did not want his son to go to California. He wanted his son to stay there. He was so hungry for affection from somebody that meant something and knew something about him that he would even rather have the son sit around there and ignore the TV set.
I think it seems like in the parliamentary chat or in Escape from Wine, it's about two parents differing. Like, I don't think Tom and Black Cat together, like Tom Green, they're always sort of against each other on different sides. I mean, not always, but.
Yeah, it was. There is a part there that talks about it very well. That there's they pick sides, they choose sides and so forth.
I hear that unless the parents can totally get together, something doesn't work.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's probably her fault that she didn't come to him and tell him what she thought. She
Let him do his thing, and she did her behind the scenes, and patchwork. Yeah. I don't always see that parents should do exactly the same things, but not to work allies.
Not the opposite. I feel like one parent being favored, one against, and also the next one the opposite being favored, one against.
Yeah. This thing that you were saying, there's a. Another thing besides control, which way of on the surface, lots of times it can look like, you know, that it's just control that's the problem there. You want the control of this child. You can manipulate this child and want control. There's another way of looking at that is that they have when the parents do not give their children what they stones. Now, the child might think it was a stone, but the parent doesn't knowingly give the child a stone. Now, there may be certain cases somewhere in Outer Mongolia where parents purposefully give their children serpents, but they usually don't live long enough to tell about it. But the parent really is giving what I think has to be assumed by person is giving what they believe is the best in terms of values. And when it is a really, I would imagine, a really frightening thing when the child starts saying, you know, you've given me stone, you've given me serpent.